Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the Coffee Clatch. This is Marianne Russo. I'd like to acknowledge my moderators, Elise, Jane, Pierrette, and Chuck, who will be on our tweet chat. Our guest tonight is Robin Rice, an author, a shaman, a very wonderful lady, and the mother to Taylor Morris, who was our guest last Sunday in part one. And I'm just so happy to have her. Robin, thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I think you know how I feel about your daughter. I mean, she is just delicious. And, you know, she's just such an inspiration. And, you know, I would really like people to get to know you as well as Taylor because, you know, you are the mother behind, you know, this inspiration. And, you know, I thought we'd start off a little bit, excuse me, about talking about when you first heard the diagnosis about Taylor and, you know, what presentations she had. And we'll talk a bit about how you got to where you are now.
Okay, sure. So you want me to just jump right in with getting that diagnosis?
Sure. I mean, you know, because I think everybody remembers that moment.
Yeah.
You know, and everyone handles it differently. But I think that universally, you know, parents are just in shock. We're frightened. You know, a lot of parents are given a death sentence, you know, pretty much for their children that they're never, never, never. So why don't you tell us your story and you know, how you turned it around?
Yeah. Well, I had sensed that there was something wrong. And, you know, like a lot of parents, I had heard the message of, you know, well, she just isn't talking, and, you know, Einstein didn't talk till he was three, and, you know, all these kinds of things. And, but there's something that a mother knows. And I was really watching, and I'm a very observant person, being a writer and a detail-oriented person. I was very observant. And so I really started trying to figure out, well, what exactly was it that was different? And she wasn't pointing to say that she wanted something. You could have food in front of her plate, and you could have a whole banquet, and if, you know, if all she had directly in front of her was crackers, then that's what she would eat, and she wouldn't ask for anything else. And she had words when she was one, and by two, she didn't have them, and wasn't really trying to communicate. She was very affectionate, which was unusual, you know, on the autism spectrum, at least by the classic definition that everybody was going by at that point.
I like how Elise puts it. Elise says, if you've met one child with autism, you've met one child with autism. And
exactly.
It's so true.
Exactly. So, you know, I finally just said, no, there's definitely something wrong. And I went and had her evaluated and, you know, through the child find and that sort of thing. And they came back and, you know, in some ways, you're sort of like advocating, no, I know there's something wrong. And then when it actually comes back and you get the diagnosis, you just sit there and think, how could there be something wrong with my child? What are you talking about? I did not expect
you don't know
it to
whether.
Be as... Yeah, I mean, I was glad that it was found, but at the same time, it was, you know, 50% across the board, you know, with a little bit of variation here and there and some scattered skills. But it was pretty clear that I didn't think she was that far off.
Did you have a child before her?
I did, and he wasn't on the spectrum. So,
right.
You know, we just wasn't. I mean, like most people, I had no introduction to it. It was interesting because I sort of had my own spiritual introduction to it when I was a child. Because when I was 13 years old, I had a very prominent dream about an autistic child. And it was one of the most beautiful love, you know, sense of just like love, amazing energy around this child. And it got me to go read Sunshine and some of the other books about autism. And, of course, I promptly forgot about all of it when I got older. But I, you know, I remembered that. And I remembered that, you know, I mean, Taylor was a very special child to me. I wasn't going to have another child. And so there was a lot of story around it, and it was very profound. And it was devastating to me, but at the same time, it wasn't because I had been through many deaths in my life. And so I said, you know, if she's alive, we can work with it. You know, if she's not alive, I can't work with it. But if she's alive, I can work with it. And I was, you know, I took that tiny little bit of, you know, of that sense of potential and just milked it for all it was worth.
Well, you know what, we've spoken quite a bit. You know, we have been communicating now for probably almost a year. I mean, I had approached Robin when I was first thinking of forming the Coffee Clutch. And we had spoke about her possibly joining us and other ventures. And, you know, the road that it's taken, I mean, even just the transformation in Taylor in the year.
Yeah.
But, you know, I remember you talking about how, excuse me, you know, when you got the diagnosis, I mean, you were devastated. I think you went through what all parents go through, that period of just not knowing what to do and depression and everything else.
I thought she was a different child. I mean, I really, you go through a sense of you think you know who this child is, which is totally formed in your own head, you know, anyway, and who they're going to be and all of that. And then that part does die. And you have to build it on a whole different foundation after that.
And, you know, you're a very spiritual person. And how did you use it? Is that what got you through it? Because when we had spoken, you know, way back when, you had told me that, I mean, the doctors were really, you know, it was really gloom and doom what they had told you when you got the diagnosis. And, you know, like many parents, I mean, we hear it, and I think, you know, we say in our minds, well, you know, they're just giving us the worst-case scenario, and you do with that information what you will. And, you know, I think a lot of parents get very, you know, feel there's no hope. And then there are other parents that just say, no, that's not the way this is going to be, you know. And obviously that's how you looked at it.
Well, it's interesting because I didn't, at first, it was still so new, I didn't expect her to have such a turnaround. I didn't know what to expect because they weren't willing to say what would or wouldn't happen. And that was actually really infuriating for me because I wanted them to tell me what I had on my hands and they wouldn't. They said, we don't know. You know, she might never talk, she might never leave home, she might never have any skills, or she might, you know, do okay and eventually over time get some skills. And but so there really wasn't a sense of what we were looking at. And but I wanted to know what caused this. I wanted to know what happened. I was searching for any kind of clue. And the biggest clue that I had written letters to my son and my daughter every month from the time they were conceived. And so I was able to go back and I would look at, you know, he was 4 years older, so I could look at everything and compare month by month what was happening and why was she fine at a year and not fine at two. And what we had found in her particular case was that we had switched from soy milk to regular milk because she was a year and that was kind of the standard procedure. And I decided, well, what the heck, I'm going to try and take her off the milk for a while. And within 3 days, we had an entirely different experience on our hands. I mean, she was still a year behind, but she was looking at things. She was pointing. She was starting to connect the dots. And you know, the doctors all said, well, this can't happen, and, you know, it's a coincidence and blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, that's just too crazy because this is a very different, I mean, I live with her. This is a different child. And so we ended up going to Georgetown Pediatrics Hospital and a research center. And sure enough, the gastroenterologist there, which we had to pay for because, the insurance refused to believe there was anything that, you know, was connected, he pulled out three studies that were 20 years old and said, yes, we've seen this before. Most doctors don't know about it. And so I knew then what I knew, that she, you know, basically he said it was in her case, and this is not true of all kids, but, you know, I always say you might as well try. You know, the mucus wasn't getting, there was a mucus in her brain that the milk was creating, so the electrical connections weren't getting across. And when you took her off, that mucus, which, you know, pretty much anybody can feel when, you know, when you cough after having ice cream and that sort of thing, that was happening in her head, and it cleared up within about 3 days, and she was suddenly just able to get things going. And that doesn't mean she doesn't still have what we call an aspie mind. She's very, you know, she very much does. But she was able to connect the dots in a new way, including with language. And so she started talking. She started, you know, getting all of her, you know, pieces put all together in the right order and all that sort of thing. And so then, and then she was able to function more and more until by the time she was in fourth grade, she really didn't need special services anymore. And at that point, I thought we were kind of done. I thought, wow, that was, you know, a major event of life that kind of went past us. And I didn't realize until she started making these videos, I didn't realize how much it was still a part of her life. Because
really?
it wasn't a part of our life. I mean, it was.
Oh,
but
that I didn't know. That's shocking to me.
Yeah,
interesting to me.
Yeah, I thought we dodged a bullet. I didn't.
Well, you know, because when Taylor was on last week, she spoke about that feeling of being trapped, and at an early age, and she spoke about how when certain events would happen, if she was on a swing and the swing would be stopped, or you know, whatever the case may be, she knew that there was an expectation of her to do something. And she knew what the expectation was, but she wasn't able to communicate it.
Right.
And, you know, what a frustrating feeling that was. And even, you know, as she was, you know, growing up, how she was different and how she, you know, for those who didn't listen to the interview, Taylor did not tell her friends or family that she was on the spectrum. That just came out months ago after the videos. So, I mean, she was very
brave. Well, obviously we knew.
Her
close family did, but...
Mm-hmm.
Her close family knew, but, you know, but she didn't tell her community, and we didn't need to tell her teachers anymore because she learned to handle it so well. And, I mean, that's not to say I didn't know she had a nasty mind. I just didn't put it in those terms. She was just Taylor. And I didn't.
Right.
I hadn't studied autism. I hadn't studied Asperger's syndrome. I didn't realize that this was still very classical for her early history.
And I
learned
think, you know,
more.
That's such a profound thing, really, that we're discussing, because I think that's such a misconception that people have, is that, you know, autism is always on the severe end of the spectrum, and
it's just not
the case.
Exactly.
And, you know, it really is a very important thing, and that's, you know, tomorrow we're having a very, very big event, and it's things like this that, you know, people need to know, that you would not know necessarily that somebody has an Aspie mind, and an Aspie mind is a fantastic thing. I mean, she talked to us about how she goes into the other world and how creative it is, and I mean, you know, how the brilliant people with Aspie minds, you know, that are just doing such amazing things and is so productive. And, you know, for Taylor, you know, she speaks so fondly of you. I mean, you really did have early interventions. She got all of the help that she needed. And she's also fortunate because, you know, there are a lot of children that are on the spectrum that also have learning disabilities and have delays in their learning, and it's difficult to educate, and she didn't have that. But some of the interventions that you did, I know that she had animal therapy. I mean, there were a lot of things that you did. So why don't you tell us a few of those things, and you know, then we'll start moving on to some of the other things, because we have a lot to talk about tonight.
Yeah. Well, we basically kept her with her school services, whatever they recommended, and we went and went outside and had her evaluated by other, you know, other places to evaluate the progress that was going on, because we were seeing it, but we wanted to see how it was going. We started to work with her on some computer-based programs, and those were an absolute disaster. They were terrible for her self-esteem, and so I took her off of those almost immediately because it was just being destructive to her confidence. But we did therapeutic riding, and we did something called Brain Gym, which was very helpful. It's not something that most people even know about, but it basically crosses the left and right hemispheres of the brain with some exercises that kids do, and she blossomed when we would do that when she would have difficulties in school or anything along those lines. But, you know, most of all, part of it was just sort of the parenting. My parenting style is to follow the child. And by that, I don't mean the child runs the house. I mean that the child will tell me what's working, what isn't working, if I'm listening. And if I'm trying to impose upon her who she's supposed to be and how she's supposed to be, I'm not listening. And since I was listening, I could hear, well, this works for her and this doesn't. And I knew she still needed to pace, and I knew that she still had some, you know, different, you know, posturings and things that were going on, and I was able to work with her on those to just become aware of them and decide where she wanted to display them and where she didn't. And
well, that's an important thing, too, because the parents need to teach the children how to transition from those stereotyping and when they are into what we call the other world, you know, and it does transform as they get older.
Absolutely.
You know, and it's, you know, I think you and there are so many other mothers out there that have been on the show and that I speak to, that it's so important that you don't try to take them out of who they are. And, you know, that's not saying that you have to let them go into the cocoon of an autistic world, but you do have to meet halfway. You have to accept the differences in the child. And,
absolutely,
you know, it's so much better for the child.
Right. And you know, that you said, you know, if you know one autistic child, you know one autistic child. The question I have for parents is, do you know your child? And do you trust that you know your child? And do you trust that there's something right about the way your child is? Because that's really critical, is that you don't take the outside expert view and assume that, well, that's my child now, when it goes against what you already know. You know, and that's, it's really important, because your child is a soul, is a human being, is a unique personality. I don't care how disabled they are. They have a unique self that is here in the world for a reason. So to bypass that and try to fix them in all the social ways is to miss the point if that's all you're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, every child has a gift, and it's finding that gift. And like I say all the time, look beyond the diagnosis.
Yeah.
You know, look at that brilliant, wonderful kid and look past the diagnosis. And, you know, it's amazing what's there. And when you really start to work with that, you know, things start to happen. And I know that, you know, that's a lot of what you did with Taylor. And, you know, you also had a background that had given you, I think, I don't know how to word it, but it almost gave you a strength, because you are a shaman, which I will not even pretend to know. But really,
and mind you,
Taylor.
I was not when she was diagnosed.
Oh, okay, so
that
came later on. But you were a spiritual person, I mean,
absolutely.
Speaking to you. I mean, I'm a very spiritual person also,
yes.
And I think that's something that, you know, is just something that's always with you. So, as I said, I'm not even going to pretend to know what a shaman is. So, you know, you are a shaman. I mean, you're an author of several books, and you've studied. And, you know, I think that you've gotten a bit of peace and tranquility from that. And,
oh, yeah.
You know, maybe if you could share that and, you know, how that, and then later on we're going to talk about how that's brought you to where you are now.
Sure. Well, shamanism is never easy to explain, but I'll give you the basic version that's the easiest version. And the reason I say that is because there's, you know, everyone, just like there's a whole spectrum of autism, there's a whole spectrum of spirituality. And there's lots of people who are, you know, mildly spiritual, and there's people who are extremely spiritual. And so, you know, and different religions are all different. So I would say shamanism is not a religion at all. It's a way of being in the world. We would say that throughout all cultures and throughout all time, there have been, we know there's, you know, pictographs and petroglyphs and all this kind of thing that show us, you know, people in a shamanic posture, if you will, a shamanic position of going into a trance state, which is very interesting that the autistic people have their own world as well. But the shaman was found in every tribe throughout all time. There's usually one or two. Very often it was inherited through the family, whether you had a gift. And this gift would be something specific, like being a seer, so seeing things that can't be seen, what we might loosely call a psychic today, a healer, a natural healer. There could be a warrior, so shamans were the warriors of the tribe, using energy instead of weapons. And so there were a lot of different ways that the shamans worked within a tribal system. And what happens is that we have a lot of these people in the world today, but we don't have any system for it. We don't have any training for it in modern culture. So many of these people, they're super intuitive. They just know things. They know when the phone's going to ring. They know something that they're not necessarily supposed to know. And oftentimes, even as children, this is the case. And so that was the case for me. I used the classic line, I saw dead people when I was five, and I had a lot of death in my life, so I had plenty of opportunity, unfortunately. But I really didn't do anything with it. I kept it kind of in the back, and I was extremely, extremely intuitive. And again, I wasn't raised in a tradition where there was any room for any of that. So I just basically put it aside and assumed that, you know, everybody could read everybody's mind and, you know, all that sort of thing. Mm-hmm.
I call it, you know, old souls, you know.
There you go. Exactly.
My daughter is an old soul. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, but
you know,
but
you
then
mentioned,
I'm
sorry, go ahead.
Okay. When I had just before my 35th birthday, I had a very profound spiritual experience in which I would call it waking up and realizing that this world was much more than just the world that that I was normally living in. And my honest response was, you know, took you long enough. Gosh, I can't believe I believed this was real for 35 whole years. You know, why didn't you wake me up sooner? And I began a new path. And, of course, by then, you know, Taylor was already five, and we'd gone through, you know, the diagnosis, and she was, you know, doing much better, and I had gone through a recent separation with her father. And so a lot of things were in process. But that felt to me very much like, you know, the right time of waking up for me in retrospect now. And so I tried to figure out what is the tradition out there, because I was completely unprepared for this experience. You know, what's the tradition that helps me explain this the most and explain the gifts that I came with the most? And shamanism was the closest of any healing tradition that I found. So that was what got me into it.
Now, you know, before you mentioned energy,
mm-hmm.
and I know I'm interested in this because we have been using acupuncture with the doctor of Chinese medicine on my daughter,
mm-hmm.
and the results are astounding. And initially, well, you know, when I saw her, you know, and this isn't for autism, this is for, you know, anxiety. But
uh-huh.
she said that she needed to shift the energy. And
uh-huh.
I can tell you that within 2 weeks, the results were amazing. So what is the energy in the body? And people that may be interested in using alternative treatments and healing, what is the energy in the body and why is there a premise that if you shift this energy, there's a calming effect on the child?
Well, that's a really big question. And you're asking for, there's a lot of pieces of that answer. So I'll try to answer parts of that as much as I can. But in each situation is somewhat different. And Chinese medicine through acupuncture is a particular way of working with energy that's not necessarily the same as, say, a shaman would or a Reiki master or whatever. There's different ways. I mean, energy is energy, but there's different ways of dealing with it. So what basically it means is that, I mean, if you were to stand in front of someone and be talking to them, and say they took a step closer, and you began to get either uncomfortable, or if you really like them, you were more happy. but there's a sense that when you get closer, when the energy fields are getting closer, there's a sense of being either uncomfortable or comfortable, and that is not something, you're still not touching, so there's nothing logical about it, but everyone knows that experience of standing too close to someone and they're not being comfortable. And you can say that's personal space and you can say that's, you know, cultural or whatever. But in reality, many people who are sensitive can actually feel the shift in energy from one person to another. And if I stand too close to someone who's, say, off balance or not doing very well, then it upsets my energy. It upsets the field around me. And we found that this is very real. This sense of energy is very real. So that might be the energy that extends beyond the body. But there's also energy within the body. And as I said, it's a really, really big topic. But if in your case, if she was saying, well, I need to shift the energy What she may be saying is that the energy isn't running through her body in an appropriate way. And just like the blood runs through the body and the oxygen and all of that, you need the energy to run through the body, and acupuncture specifically goes in and makes sure that the channels for that are open. And that's the entire...
And she explained to me that it was a thermal regulation that it was, which, I mean, whatever. But, I mean, you know, a lot of people, I know that, you know, some people that may be listening may be thinking, you know, well, this is like, you know, hocus pocus. But, I mean, it really is amazing. I mean, I've seen it with my own eyes. And, you know, I just thought of something as we're talking and you were just explaining what shamanism is. You know, you use Walk Into Worlds. I think that's your website. Okay.
That's actually my spirit name.
The Walk Into Worlds, when Walk Into Worlds, when I had been seeing it for the past year, I always interpreted that to be the tailor walks into worlds. But
right.
Now as I'm listening to you talk about this, it's you that's walking into worlds. So
yes.
What is the Walk Into Worlds? That's interesting to me now.
It is. It's very interesting. Yeah. No, I had that name long before she decided to do this. That's actually my spirit name. And I actually walk in more than two worlds, but you know, again, this is something that's really complex to explain. But the bottom line is that this is not the only world we're living in. This is the five senses, your basic hardcore reality, is one level of our existence, and there are other levels, and occasionally those levels break through. Through synchronicity, through intuition, through a lot of different ways do the other worlds break through. And the shaman is simply one who intentionally can move between them and actually create changes in the other worlds so that they show up here. And I know that sounds really, wild and wacky. And I always tell people, I'm a really smart woman. I would not do this if it didn't work. There would be no way you could get me to do this if it didn't work. And I can't even tell you why or how it works. I only know that it does, and I only use it for good. I'm very, very clear about that. It's only used for good. Now,
that's where I was heading with this, is that you are coaching now, if that's the right word. About a year ago, as I said, when we first started talking, you didn't know what direction you were going to head in. I didn't know what direction I was going to head in. And Taylor was, I think I did her first interview, and she was, so nervous. And, you know, you've made a decision. And why don't you tell the audience what you're doing now? Because you are helping parents, on this journey.
Yeah. Well, I knew what I was doing with the rest of my life. I just didn't know what I wanted to do with the autism side of it now, because
right.
it's fascinating to me. So I am working with some families, some autistic children who are nonverbal, through shamanism to create change, and it's amazing. And I actually have another friend who I think is listening tonight, Sandy, who is a shaman, and she works also with special needs children. And, you know, the shaman heals from a level of the soul. And the soul of every child, I don't care how verbal or how functioning they are, the soul of every child is there. It's hopefully intact. The shaman, of course, works if there's a problem with that. But in a way, you can break through. If they have another world, you can journey to that other world and interact with them in a way that you can never do it here. And again, that sounds really crazy, but when you actually see a child start to settle down, start to try new habits that they haven't had in years and years and years, start hugging a parent again after not having hugged, maybe more than once a month for years, or started for the first time. When you start seeing changes like that, you know something is working and something is happening. And very often, I'm now trained. I've traveled all over the world, and I've trained with shamans from, indigenous tribes, and from different parts of the world. It's very similar no matter where you travel in the world. The traditions are different, but the essence of it is the same. And I've learned how to journey into the world and actually find someone else's world. And you know, when you're dealing with special needs children, there's no way in many cases for them to say, yeah, you're right. You know, I mean, it's very challenging that way because they can't say, yes, that's what my world is about a lot of the time. So how are you going to prove it except for that, you know, some kind of results are showing up? But I have worked for many years with people who were not special needs, who were seeking spiritual healing in this way, and over again, I would find things that were absolutely true that they had no way of knowing, you know, over again. It was amazing. And that's how I knew that it worked, and that's how I knew I was getting into people's soul stories, if you will. Does that sound totally, I mean, am I explaining it well enough for you? I know it's kind of off the wall.
Oh, no, no, you're explaining it just fine. You know, and as with everything else, you know, there are people that will be open to it, and there are people that won't be open to it, and
sure.
This is your story. And you know, and it's a very interesting story. I mean, you aren't even involved in this when you were, when Taylor was going through it and when you were helping her. But it's leading me to talk to you about something that, you know, you and I have discussed, which is productivity among parents. And, you know, mostly moms, but I mean dads too. But, you know, raising a special needs child is a very, very difficult journey. And,
yeah.
You know, the emotional impact that it has on the parent is, you know, can be very overwhelming. I mean, there are many parents that are just develop anxiety states that wind up being very depressed, overwhelmed. And I think that parents, and particularly stay-at-home parents, wind up just getting into a funk. And,
yeah.
You know, you can stay there, and it's not good for you, and it's not good for the kids. And, you know, that's where being productive becomes so important. And, you know, being productive in anything, it doesn't have to be involved in the special needs community. It doesn't have to be with, you know, working with children, just being productive. And, you know, you've taken this path, and you're helping people, and, you know, I'm doing the Coffee Clutch, but it's so important to be productive. And, you know, you meet a lot of women because you are the creator of the Awesome Women Hub.
Yes. Yep.
And, you know, how did you start that? And, you know, how do you find that women, you know, especially parents of special needs children, are able to become productive?
Oh, you ask such good questions. They're such big questions.
Okay, I'll try to tone them down a bit.
No, it's fine. The Awesome Women Hub is on Facebook, and we just reached 10,000 women. And, you know, I'm very multifaceted, and I was fascinated by the potential for Facebook in specific to be a game changer for the small fry, the small person, the person who needed a megaphone, who was never going to be heard in a traditional advertising society, and who now has a voice, and giving people a voice, whatever they want to use it for. I always say I only work with people who want to change the world. I don't care how you want to change the world, as long as it's for the better. But so I created the Awesome Women Hub with a new paradigm of a way of being, and I wanted to see if it would work. And basically what I did was, instead of having a page where it's my page and it's all about me and I'm going to tell you about me and hopefully you'll buy from me and you'll, you know, I'm a mentor to women leaders, so I could have made it all about, you know, how wonderful a mentor I am and all that kind of thing. But instead what I did was, like, and I did have another page that was my own page that was for Be Who You Are. But this particular Awesome Women Hub, I decided to design it on a new model, and I call it the Generosity Model. And so that page is specifically there for women to be able to express who they are and then tell us a little bit about what they do and what they're putting out in the world, and to connect with each other. And there are women who come every day to see who has posted about themselves so they can make connections with women of like mind. And it was hugely successful very quickly. And as I said, we've gotten to 10,000, and that's in just about, I think it's about 8 months, maybe 9 months now, that it's been out.
It's such a great thing. It's such a great thing because you're really validating,
absolutely,
you know, the everyday woman out there. And, you know, I mean, the everyday women, and well, this is a women's hub, but, I mean, you know, remarkable women. I do have a question from the chat room.
Yep.
And the question is, from a shaman's point of view, what is this world?
Ooh, wow.
Now, you think I had big questions.
I know, I was going to say another big world.
That's a good one.
You know, there's layers and levels. And so I will try to answer it as clearly as I can. This is one layer and level of reality. It is the one that we find to be the most real, because our senses are so acute. And so we taste things and we touch things and we hear things and we see things around us. And this is very, very real to us because that's how we're oriented. But a shaman would say that this is not the most real world, that in fact this is an illusion. It's just a very, very powerful illusion. And that there's a far greater existence on many layers and levels than this one. And so this one is the one that we're in. I was born here. I don't know why. I guess I decided to come and hang out with their, you know, whatever, the people of our time. But we are more than that. And so the shaman would say that this is one world. It's a perfectly wonderful world. It's a great world. It's just not the only one. And this is not the only reality. In fact, even within our world, you know, your reality and my reality are vastly different. We only think that we're actually agreeing on a lot of things. But I can promise you that someone living in the slums, you know, in another country is having a very different experience than I am. And I may think I know what their experience is, but I really don't. So the shaman
I think even people of a common culture and status.
I think people who are married are in different worlds.
Right.
I've done marriage counseling before, and I thought these people can't possibly live in the same house.
Well, that's a whole different reality.
Exactly.
But you know, I think that when we're talking about autism, also that it seems to me that that other world, that place where they go, is just a different reality. And, you know, I know that, you know, when I spoke with Taylor, and many others also have said the same thing, it's a regulatory tool. It's a calming tool. It's a very good, happy place because it's a place that they create.
Yes.
But to me, it just always seemed, I mean, even hearing it from my child, that it's just a different reality. And it's not a bad place. And, you know, I spoke with Taylor, and that was one of the, you know, I felt most important questions that I asked her was that, you know, what do you think about, you know, parents that get all freaked out because their kids go into this other world? And, you know, and she was just, you know, wonderful because she said it's just a movie going on in her head. It's a calming thing, and it's okay, you know. Like she said, it's fine. Just leave them alone, you know. And I think that it really, it sounds like it's just a different reality. And if that's
what's interesting, the connector here, if I can tell you a quick story that might give you an example of the connector. Because when she says she's in another world, I get that. I mean, I understand that she's creating it. But when we're creating another world, are we really creating out of nothing? Are we really creating out of our own experiences? I mean, she was telling me when she was 4 years old, you know, when she would wake up and she just had a few words. She didn't have a lot of words, you know, but she was articulate enough. She would tell me about, you know, about other worlds then. And she would come from the dream state and tell me about those worlds in detail. I mean, in incredible detail.
It's very detailed. It is incredible. It almost reminds me of visualization, almost, in a way.
Yeah.
You know, it may not be visualization as far as a goal. I mean, I know that, you know, there are, I've used, you know, visual. I mean, I know that there are, you know, corporate leaders that use visualization to see their goals ahead of them. But this is a different type of visualization that they do. But it does seem to me that they are on a different level of existence when they're there.
They are clearly checked out of this one, and they are traveling in some other energetic realm or something along those lines. So let me tell you a quick story, because it's a funny story, but it proves the point here. I was writing one of my books. I write fiction, and I decided I was going to create this character, and I was just kind of going wild, having a good time. I made him this really hot guy with his, you know, he had kind of a muscle shirt, and he had long dreadlocks, and he was, you know, this gorgeous with big smiling teeth and all this stuff, and I decided, you know, I was going to make him, you know, all real hip, and he wore his pants so low that you could see his, you know, the crack of his bottom, you know, from the top, and I just thought I was creating this really cool guy. And when I was researching later the god from the pre-Celtic times that he was, the Dagda, when I was researching him, after I'd created him, mind you. I was researching for detail and for some richness to it and all that sort of thing. I'm reading down, and they say, well, the one thing that defines him in all the literature is that he always wears pants so the crack in his butt shows. Now, what is the likelihood that I'm going to think of that for the very guy that it is? Somehow, I tapped into something that was actually, I mean, it's written. It's all out there. And this happens again and again and again when you're breaking through. And I believe that these kids, the fact that we have letters from so many other kids on the autism spectrum who write us from these Taylor's videos and say that their worlds are the same, that the structures
yes.
are very similar, they're going for the same reasons, they do the same things, and none of them got the idea from each other. That's
Absolutely.
Amazing. That's amazing.
It is amazing because even though what their worlds are like are so completely different, it's the way they get there and the feeling that they have, the feeling of just complete calm, that seems to be very universal.
Absolutely.
And, you know, Taylor is just such an advocate, and, she's moving on, she's going to college, and, how has the stress of, I mean, because she seems to be doing beautifully, I mean, she's in the IB program, which we spoke about, which is a very grueling academic program, and she's been applying to colleges. Have you found that the anxiety, the stress of all of this has affected her? Has, her stimming become worse, or has she come to a point now where she can handle things?
I would say it's actually the opposite. By coming out, she's no longer as stressed about trying to hide it. She was trying
to
hide.
To not be who you are, especially I told her, I mean, for her to have to hide who she is when she is so exceptional had to be so difficult for her. And there are so many kids that are just trying to be quote-unquote normal when there is no normal. And,
yes.
It's just such a shame because these are just terrific kids that should just be who they are,
Yeah, and, I mean, she was raised in a be-who-you-are household, and so what she felt was that it was fine at home to be who she was, but not necessarily out there. And mind you, she was still very shy of anyone seeing her doing her stimming or any of those kinds of things,
mm-hmm.
but she's always been a very private person. But now that it's out there, it's... It was actually funny. We went out to dinner with some other people on the spectrum, and I was the only neurotypical there. And it was absolutely fascinating because, as Taylor said at one point in the dinner, she just laughed and she said, "Do you know that one of us is always doing something weird?" She was so at home. She was so at home with knowing
right.
that it was perfectly fine. And they were asking each other, "Ooh, what weird things do you do?" I was absolutely in bliss watching these four people, amazing human beings, very accomplished human beings, finding comfort in each other's oddities. It was just amazing to watch.
And and tomorrow we have the Communicate to Educate, which is a 24-hour chat that we're doing to give new people with autism a voice. And, that's what I'm hoping is really going to come out is that, with all of their little, quirks and everything else, which, by the way, is not just reserved to the autistic world.
Exactly. That's very true. We call them oddities to us, but, like I said, I was the neurotypical there, and I was definitely the odd woman out.
And it's funny because, it always amazes me when people think, that there are those perfectly normal families. Well, find one, because I think that every family has, oddities and differences, and there's no perfect life and there's no perfect family. And quite frankly, if you want to talk about acceptance, with 1 in 110 children being born on the spectrum, being diagnosed on the spectrum, that is a huge population of
yeah.
Aspies that are going to be in the adult generation.
Absolutely. We will have a different world,
you know,
a generation from now.
And the world is better for it, and that's really what I'm hoping is going to come out tomorrow, is that, you know, people are going to have this myth about what autism is and what autism isn't really, really made perfectly clear. Because I do not diminish in any way, you know, the difficulties and the challenges of the parents and the children that are very severe on the spectrum. It is horrendous and it is heart-wrenching. But that is the very, you know, severe end of the spectrum. And for the most part, we're talking about very high-functioning people that think differently, that learn differently, but that are such a contribution.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's my goal for tomorrow. I just can't wait for everybody to come out, because I'm hoping that tomorrow will be your dinner.
That's wonderful.
You know,
that's wonderful.
It should be really, really interesting. But why don't you tell us a little bit? I know that you've written some books. And were the books related to shamanism, or are they related to autism, you know, parenting?
Well, I've been an author since before I was out of college. I wrote a book on in-home childcare. I wrote a book on sudden infant death syndrome. I wrote a book. I've written quite a lot, you know, with that, with nonfiction sort of thing. But for the last 3.5 books, because I've got one that's half done, it's been spiritual fiction. So that is just a ball to me. That's really, really fun. So that's what I do now as far as fiction writing, although I've taken a year off from writing, so I'm trying to figure out where I'm going back in exactly.
So we're back there again, huh?
Yeah, always. No,
that's great. I know. And,
creating.
You know, that's a good thing, too, because as, you know, as we're trying to have our kids evolve, we need to evolve, too, which is why I really wanted you to come on also, because, you know, you've done it. You know, you went through this journey. I mean, it's never over, you know. I mean, I have a 24-year-old daughter who I still worry about. But, you know, you get through it, and, you know, it's through whatever it is. I mean, you found it in your spiritual belief. Others will find it in their religious belief. You know, I, for myself, just find it in, I don't know if it's just being stubborn, but, you know, I'm just not willing to agree that she wasn't going to be, you know, that she just wasn't going to be productive and that she just wasn't going to excel at everything. And I think that that's part of it, too, is that, you know, like it's important what you said before, that, you know, at home the kids can have their disorder and be who they are.
And the parents, too. You bring up a good point with that. I agree. And you bring a good point with the parents, too, though, because every parent has a journey that's initiated by a diagnosis, a personal journey. What do they feel about life? What do they feel about themselves? What do they feel about you know, God or whatever? And this huge journey is initiated, and almost immediately you're required to put yourself on the back burner because there's just way too much that needs to be done for the child. And so you put those two together, and very often parents don't get what they need. They don't know how to take care of themselves. They don't have someone to walk them through the journey. And, you know, I've worked with so many people as a mentor over many years that the truth is that every single situation is completely unique, and every single situation, every single life follows certain signposts of the journey. There isn't any way to get out of the grief, the rediscovery, the going underground, the coming back up, all of the different things that we do. And there is no final end point. You know, there is no, you know, now I've done everything. We are creating ourselves again and again. But the parents put this on hold, and that is also dangerous to the family as a whole. The parents need, the mothers, the fathers need to allow themselves to have this journey that they're on,
and
as
yeah,
well.
That's so important, because this is a process. And, you know, anybody that's listening who's newly diagnosed, or even if, you know, it's not a new diagnosis and you're struggling, we've been where you are. Which is why both of us do what we do, which is why Elise does what she does, because we've been there. We know how hard it is. We didn't come onto this journey with the confidence and the knowledge that we have. It took
a very
long time. And, you know, I think that's when it comes to acceptance. And one of the things that is really important for me to get out to everybody is acceptance is not accepting the diagnosis. Acceptance is accepting the life the diagnosis gives you. And that is one of my opinion, one of the biggest, I mean, that's one of the biggest stumbling blocks for a lot of people. And once you come to that reality, when you stop beating yourself up over, what did I do that caused this? What didn't I do that caused this? What caused this? When you get past that and you start to look at what steps am I going to take? Because I may not find a cure. I'm going to do the best I can to give this child a happy life. That's when the progress really comes in, because that's when everything starts to fall into place.
And you can't make that peace happen. You can only go through what you're actually going through and not put off whatever it is. So you go through the grief. You go through the shock. You go through the denial.
You go through
the anger. You go through all of that, and you will move on to the next stage when you have authentically completed the one that you're in. And when will that be? Well, each person is different. But you go through it. I mean, that's what I can suggest more than anything else is don't back burner it. Just go through it, and you will not be here forever. There's no way you will be here forever.
Absolutely. And, you know, and it's funny because everybody experiences just like you know, grieving. Everybody grieves differently.
Yes.
You know, we had a tragic loss, and my husband and I dealt with it completely differently. I wanted to stay in bed with the covers over my head, and my husband needed to be with people all the time.
Uh-huh.
So was one way better than the other? No. And it's the same thing with this journey. So, you know, you're going to get there. And, you know, you're going to get to the point of acceptance, but you have to go through everything. You have to go through the frustration, the pain, the heartache, but you're going to get there. And, you know, it's people like Robin that are going to help you. So, you know, I really wanted you to come on because I want so much to give parents that are struggling some hope. That, you know, it's not going to be like this forever. And, you know, like I said, you found, you know, your shamanism and, you know, your spiritual person, and that got you through. I think I'm just the most stubborn person on the world. I think.
Hey, it works
I just
for
said,
you,
oh, no.
Right?
I don't think so. Right. But, you know, everybody will find their way to get through it. And, you know, I appreciate everything that you, you know, you do, that you come on. I appreciate that you've shared your daughter with us.
Thank you.
And I appreciate the awesome Women Hub, because I think that that's just really making women feel good about themselves, because women, you know, often feel so unappreciated.
It's very true. It's very true. And it's so easy to do. Facebook was great when they created the like button. Use it freely. Like people all over the place. Right. That's my philosophy. You know, they gave us a chance to affirm other people with a simple click, and I use it all the time.
Yep, and it's true. It just makes people feel so much better.
Yeah, you see a little like under something that you said, you walk around differently that day.
Absolutely. And where do you find these women?
They find it. They find it.
They find you, true.
Yeah, mostly they find me. You know,
what,
I mean,
what
we
is
do...
the name of that website? Because you know what, it really is. Like I said, it really validates people, women. So what is that on
it's...
Facebook?
Facebook.com/AwesomeWomenHub. And
you really
check
it out, because it really is very cool. You meet a lot of really interesting women on there.
And then my own page, which is much more about kind of the philosophy that I put out there and really exploring yourself and your journey, is Robin Rice's Be Who You Are. So it's actually Facebook.com/BeWhoYouAre with Robin Rice. And you can search me or find the Awesome Women Hub, and you'll find links to it, too.
Well, again, Robin, I want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Keep in touch.
Absolutely.
And, let us know.
Thanks for all you're
let
doing, and good luck tomorrow. Big day.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It is a big day. We're very excited.
Very cool.
Okay. Take care, Robin.
You bet. Bye-bye.
I just wanted to mention a little bit about tomorrow. Tomorrow, we are holding a 24-hour chat on our tweet chat for awareness of autism. It's communicate to educate. And, you know, as with everything else in the autism community, there's division about, you know, what is best. And there is an event called Shutdown, where people are shutting down their computers. And the effort really is for people to understand the frustration of the lack of communication that so many people on the spectrum experience. And, you know, we do respect that. We wish the shutdown effort much success. And what we are doing is offering an alternative for those who really feel they want to speak out. And our goal is to give the people a voice. So, you know, in a way, I agree. Turn off the Facebook for a while. Turn off the Twitter as far as just, you know, looking for the celebrities or whatever. And come over to the Coffee Klatch and be educated by people who you will be in awe of, because we really have a fantastic lineup of guest moderators. And you really are going to find out what autism is and what the people, the advocates and the people that have resources to share have to offer. So we do encourage you to join us. It's a 24-hour chat. You can find us at the Coffee Klatch. Our hashtag is TCK. And we hope that you join us. And as we end the show every day, you are your child's best advocate. If not you, then who? Become an informed, educated parent. Thank you for joining us on the Coffee Klatch.